right, friends. Greg Kokel here for Stan DeReason, and I am so glad you're joining me today because for this hour, you have a treat. And I say it's a treat because there has been very few people in my professional broadcasting career that I've actually devoted 2 whole hours to interviewing. We're not doing that today, but that just shows you how much I like this guy's work, and I like him. All right, he's received his PhD from the University of Cambridge in the philosophy of science. He directs the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute in Seattle. He is the author of The Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt, none other than Stephen C. Meyer. Stephen, what a treat to have you on board today.
It's great to be with you.
You know,
I figured out how to use the mute button there. So.
Yeah, that's okay.
Unmute.
I'm a little bit frustrated because we've had so many conversations over dinner, and I think the first one was over 30 years ago, you know, when you came to Hope Chapel, and it was before Stand to Reason. At least I can look at your lovely visage here through the miracle of digital computer stuff and not just listen to your voice, but I'd rather be sitting across the table from you and having a long conversation here that everybody gets to listen in on. So maybe we'll do that sometime soon, next time you come down to the L.A. area from Seattle. So.
Delighted we can do it via Squadcast, and a new program for me.
Yes, that's great. And here's Mr. Information. We're all struggling with the technology here, trying to get things squared away before the show started. So that was great. Now, Stephen, I have always considered your, and I think you have too, that your magnificent Signature in the Cell as a kind of magnum opus, you know. And now you've produced another tome, I think, to rival it. It's the topic of our conversation here, Return of the God Hypothesis, and if I'm not mistaken, Harper One. Yeah, that's like kind of my publisher's, Ondervan Harper. So why another book this big and this significant? Why revisit some of the material that you've talked about before in some of your other works?
Well, this book addresses a question that I didn't address in the previous two books. Signature in the Cell and Darwin's Doubt were both books making the case for intelligent design without attempting to specify the identity of the designing intelligence responsible for, for example, the digital information stored in the DNA molecule or the information that's needed both to build the first living organisms and the major new body plans that arise in the history of life. We've got these huge discontinuities in the history of life to build the animal forms or the first cell. We now know that information is required. We know that information in our experience, our uniform and repeated experience, arises from an intelligent source. So the argument of the first two books was that the digital information, the other forms of information that are present in living systems are hallmarks of a designing intelligence, that they indicate the action of a designing intelligence in the origin and history of life. But in those books, I didn't attempt to identify the intelligence responsible or to characterize it beyond the presence of basic agency, the ability to choose, to deliberate, conscious activity, for example. And many of my readers ask the natural question, well, who do you think designed life? And what can science tell us about that question? There were at least, in the way I made the case, there were at least two possibilities. The designing intelligence responsible for the origin of the information necessary to produce the first life might have been a designing agent within the cosmos, or it might be an agent that transcends or is beyond the cosmos. In other words, essentially God or an alien of some kind. As strange as the second option sounds, many prominent scientists have actually proposed that. One being none other than Francis Crick, the co-discoverer of the structure of the DNA molecule, wrote a book in 1981 called Life Itself, in which he floated this idea of panspermia. Fred Hoyle was sympathetic to the idea. Richard Dawkins even floated it as a sort of speculative hypothesis in a long interview that he gave at the end of a film called Expelled. I think he later came to regret having said this, but
It always raises the question. We don't have to get into this, but if some intelligence designed life here, then what designed that intelligent life somewhere else?
And it, you know, it does this seem to push the question back. Yeah, especially since the ultimate question is the origin of the information necessary to get life going, you can say, well, a designing intelligence on some other planet or in some other star system designed a form of life that was then transported to planet Earth. That is, mm-hmm. by the way, the panspermia hypothesis, as odd as that sounds.
Right. But you still have to then account for the tank.
Yeah, you still have to
account for their holding tank.
Right? Yeah, right, right. But you still have to account for the origin of the first cell that would have gotten the evolutionary process going in that other star system that would have resulted in that superintelligence that designed life here. So it's never been a very satisfying explanation. Mm-hmm. But I didn't want to get into that adjudicating the merits of a theistic versus a panspermia hypothesis in the mm-hmm. previous books. I just wanted to get the idea of intelligent design on the table and show its explanatory sure. power. And in this book, I wanted to address that question. And I thought that my readers were owed an explanation of what
sure.
I thought. And I've been thinking about it for 35 years
right,
because
right.
it's not just the biology that's relevant to adjudicating the question of the causal origins. We also have cosmological evidence. We have physical evidence concerning, for example, the fine-tuning. And I think when you bring those classes of evidence into the picture, into the evaluation, then the theistic hypothesis becomes very strong indeed.
Yeah. So now you got God right in your title here, and that is a change of strategy as you're describing here. But it also says return of the God hypothesis. So what's the significance of the return word?
Well, thank you. The title does invite a story. And it's a really fascinating story and one that hasn't been told adequately. We've heard from the new atheists for years that science and theistic belief have been at odds. They're in conflict. Mm-hmm. In the late 19th century, there were two revisionist works that had titles like A History of the Warfare Between Science and Christianity. And this kind of trope has been picked up by contemporary scientists who especially those who have fashioned themselves as spokespersons for science, typically new atheists like Richard Dawkins or Bill Nye the Science Guy or materialists like Neil deGrasse Tyson. And they tell this story that science and religion have always been in conflict. But in fact, the dominant view among historians of science of a period known as the Scientific Revolution is that Judeo-Christian ideas played a hugely important role in the rise of modern science, and that even very specifically biblical concepts were critical to the formation of what we call modern science. That is to say, the systemic methods of studying nature that arose in that period of time from roughly 1500 to 1700, maybe stretching back into the late medieval period as well.
Mm-hmm.
And theological concepts were critical to the rise mm-hmm. of science and that organized form of discourse or inquiry.
So what you're saying is it wasn't just that, and I know this is how it's sometimes characterized. And by the way, I think your section on the history of science is worth the price of the book, personally. Even if people go no further, that is magnificent. I read every word. I loved
Thank you.
This material. But it's so easy to characterize this warfare model, as you described. And then if you say, well, look at all these Christians that were involved, well, the pushback is everybody is a Christian then, and that doesn't mean their Christianity, their theology, any of that actually informed the way they approached the scientific enterprise that they were involved in. But this is not true at all. This had everything to do with the way they approached it and why they approached it.
Absolutely. There's a wonderful book by Rodney Stark, the historian of science who's mm-hmm. now at Baylor University. He was previously at the University of Washington, called For the Glory of God, published with Princeton University Press, which is about the theological motivation of the early scientists. And we can talk about figures like Kepler and Robert Boyle, and Sir Isaac Newton, John Ray, many, many others. But just to get a little bit more specific, here's one key concept that was critical to these folks, and that was the idea of the intelligibility of nature. They believed that you could study nature in a systematic way and that nature had secrets to reveal that would in fact be revealed by systematic study. Because nature had been made by a rational intellect, namely God Almighty, and that in making the physical universe, God had built rationality and order and evidence of design into the physical world and into the living world as well. And that same God who built that order and rationality into the physical universe had made our minds in his image and had conferred upon human beings the gift of rationality.
Right.
So that we were capable of understanding the rational order that had been built into the universe. And on that basis, they set out on this grand adventure of trying to understand the secrets that nature had concealed to that point but would reveal upon systematic study. This was a theological project from the beginning. One of my supervisors in working on Newton in my first year in Cambridge said, if you miss Newton's theism, you've missed everything.
Oh, and as I understand, I haven't read it, but in his Principia, he makes strong reference to the foundation, theistic foundation, to his enterprise. Even if maybe he wasn't a Trinitarian, so maybe you can't call him a Christian, but that's not really the point here. Whether he was saved or not, it was the worldview he was operating from.
Well, and there's some very interesting recent scholarship questioning the claim that, first, the claim was that Newton was a deist, and that's now, the first claim is that Newton was a mechanist, and that's, if you know anything about the debate about universal gravitation. He thought that gravitation was a force that operated through a distance without any direct mechanical interaction.
Right.
But then the claim was, that he was a deist. Well, that's clearly not true as well, because he thought that God was constantly acting. Again, the same supervisor once said to me that Newton's view of gravity was that it was the cause of gravity was constant spirit action. That God was active on a moment-by-moment basis. Newton also made beautiful design arguments, including in the general scolium to the Principia, a theological epilogue he wrote. But now there's scholarship even questioning the idea that he was an Arian Christian, a sort of non-Trinitarian. He was indeed very skeptical of the Athanasian formulation of the idea of the Trinity. Mm-hmm. Because he believed it brought in Greek philosophical concepts like substance that mm-hmm. were alien to biblical worldview. Mm-hmm. But there's a very interesting article I've read recently by a very good historian of science makes the case that he was a non-Athanasian Trinitarian. If you read his commentaries, Newton's commentaries on, for example, the Book of Daniel and the high regard he
Newton's biblical commentary.
They're beautiful commentaries. He knew the languages, man. He was very impressive.
Yeah.
And in the general scolium to the Principia, he paraphrases the passage in Colossians 1 talking about in God all things are held together, but the language is very similar to Colossians 1, which is an affirmation of Christ's role as a creator. So I'm not. I think this is an open question, but it's not at all settled that he was not a Trinitarian.
Okay, so that's in a certain sense an aside issue because
yeah,
the broader
totally
question
side issue,
is
but
is the role
you provoked
of his...
me. I had to say something about it.
I appreciate that insight. Thanks, Stephen.
At the very least, he was a profoundly biblical theist, and that informed his approach to science.
So why is it that Degrassi, and you mentioned him, he's the one who made the most recent iteration of the cosmos, and he characterized the impact of Newton's theism as God is a door closer and a science stopper. You make this citation in your book when the truth is exactly the opposite. What's going on there?
Well, it's, I think, just unfortunately historical ignorance. People typically read about the great scientists in science textbooks that got their information from previous science textbooks, and these mythologies arise. But if you go back to read the primary sources, it's very clear that Newton was devout and reverent. And that his theological beliefs were the inspiration for his science. Mm-hmm. Principia was a theological project. He meant to show that there were mathematical principles that had been imbued in nature by the mind of the creator.
Mm-hmm.
In the general scolium, he makes a beautiful design argument. He says, yet these bodies, referring to the planetary bodies, maintain their orbits by the law of gravity. He says, but they could have by no means have first achieved their initial position by the law alone. Instead, that the fine-tuning of the planets, he said, gives evidence of an intelligent and powerful being. Newton developed the calculus, the binomial theorem. He did the most up-to-date, cutting-edge work in the optics. And in all things, he meant to be revealing the glory of God. So the idea that these things were opposed or irrelevant is to one another is just simply false.
I just to clarify to the listeners, too, that we're talking about Newton here, but I think Newton is just a quintessential characterization of the broader point that you justify with all kinds of brilliant people who are at the foundation of the scientific project, not just the individual disciplines, but the process itself of how to learn. I have, you know, there's this old saw, and I'll just close this point about the warfare model and also reinforce that alone, the history portion of your book, is worth the price of the book. The book here again, Return of the God Hypothesis. But the old saw is the religion tells you how to go to heaven and science tells you how the heavens go. And my response to that is, it making your point, religion also tells you why science can tell you how the heavens go. Without these fundamental primary commitments that allow the structuring of science to do what it does, and these are commitments that are theological commitments, you're not going to have science telling you how the heavens go, so to speak.
I think that's correct. And also, the early scientists, upon observing nature, believed that they were seeing evidence of God's handiwork behind it. So they made design arguments. This was part of the theological project.
Okay, so I want to diverge here just on a kind of a procedural issue of how we use evidence, like scientific evidence, regarding the God question, or as you put it here in your book title, the God hypothesis. You, in the book, distinguish a kind of a rigid deductive proof for God's existence, which you're not in favor of, as I understand it, even when you're using well-established scientific facts in the premises, that this is kind of a liability for a lot of people. So you're suggesting in the book a different kind of approach of using the scientific evidences to support the existence of God, or at least to lend credibility to that project. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of what's called abductive reasoning, or just recognizing that we use it all the time. It's the way detectives reason. You reason from clues back to causes. And there are limitations of abductive reasoning. They can often have more than one cause that can explain the same effect. Mm-hmm. And so you have to have some way to adjudicate that issue when it arises, where you have an underdetermination of theory by data, is the way that the philosophers of science talk about it. And usually the way that scientists separate good hypotheses from bad when they have two or three that can explain the same evidence is they look for more evidence and see if all of the hypotheses can continue to explain the whole ensemble of evidence. So, and when that happens, then they tend to elect that hypothesis, which, if true, would best explain the widest ensemble of relevant evidence. And that's mm-hmm. called a method of inference to the best explanation. So it mm-hmm. builds on this simple abduction and allows you to kind of separate the weak from the strong hypotheses. Mm-hmm. And this is a good description of the way we reason in ordinary life, the way scientists reason in many different disciplines, in theoretical physics, in the historical sciences, which are very relevant to adjudicating theories about causal origins. And I use it both in assessing competing explanations, for example, of the origin of life or the origin of the Cambrian explosion. I used this method in my previous books. But it turns out you can take it up a notch. You can come to a penultimate conclusion. For example, I came to the conclusion that life is designed by an intelligent agent of some kind, and then you can use the same method of reasoning to assess competing explanations as to what type of entity would best describe the evidence that we have. What's the identity of the designing agent? What can science tell us about that? And so I used the method of inference to the best explanation to make an explicitly theistic argument in the book. I don't mm-hmm. deny that deductive arguments can have force in epistemic force in support
sure.
of a theistic conclusion.
I agree with you.
You can make, for example, the Kalam argument as a deductive argument. Whatever begins to exist must have a cause. The universe mm-hmm. began to exist. Therefore, the universe must have a cause. Since causes are separate from effects, the cause of the universe must be separate from itself. Therefore, it must be transcendent. I mean, you can go through that whole kind of line
sure,
of reasoning.
Sure, that's like William Lane Craig has made
yeah,
that argument.
Yeah, Craig's Kalam well. Argument, I think, can be well, has been well constructed and well defended. But I find the inference to the best explanation formalism or approach mm-hmm. more helpful. For one thing, it is essentially the same method of reasoning that we use in the sciences. And And it gets us, it keeps us, it steers us away from a false dichotomy that has afflicted a lot of Christian apologetics and theistic apologetics more generally, and that is that if you can't, on the one hand, deductive arguments purport to give you absolute certainty, but because the premises are probabilistically true, you don't ever get absolute certainty. And very often in the absence of absolute certainty, which has often been the stated intent of deductive arguments for God's existence, people will say, well, if you didn't achieve that, then we can't achieve anything at all. And people lapse towards a fideism and say, well, if we don't have certainty, then we can't know anything at all, or we have no grounds for affirming a proposition.
So
and
we just
I think
have to
inference
believe.
To the best explanation steers a middle course there and says we can have very strong grounds for affirming, for example, a theistic conclusion without necessarily having to achieve the unrealistic standard of absolute proof that is really only attainable in geometry or in,
sure.
in abstract mathematics.
You know, I have an anecdote here. I don't know. You might have heard it because I've used it a lot. But when my 16-year-old was about eight, she asked me, Papa, how do we know that God is true? Okay, so this is not a what question. This is a why question. And now I'm thinking, this is what I do for a living, but now I got to talk to my 8-year-old in a language she could understand. I thought about it for a moment, and this line sprang into my head that I use all the time now because I realize it really captured how I approach this whole project, and it's just the way you explained it. Here's what I said to her. I said, honey, the reason that we believe God is true is because he's the best explanation for the way things are. He's the best explanation. That's the explanatory power of the Christian worldview, which is precisely what you're talking about here. And the best explanation for the way things are covers a lot of territory. Your book covers three of those, basically. And just for the listener here, my guest, Stephen C. Meyer, and his new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Before I jump into those three areas, and those who have read your work, they're familiar with these areas. You treat them in a little different fashion. You structure them differently. You bring a lot more evidence to the table for the new structure, which is fabulous. I just we were supposed to have this interview like a month and a half ago, and the delay allowed me to read so much more of your book,
good.
Which was
flattered, Greg. Thank you.
Which is wonderful. I'm glad for that. But, you know, in the book, and I just want to pause here and position this question I have here, because you have in the book such powerful evidence that is scientifically established and well so that points as in virtue of explanatory power so powerfully to God as opposed to anything else, that it's a wonder to me how some of these guys don't see that. So you have that's my predicate to this question here. In the book, you have an anecdote you share about a debate you had with Michael Shermer, who I've also debated 3 hours on national radio. It was a long debate. And then you had a more private conversation afterwards with him in the limo on the way to the airport. And he made some admissions there more in private than he was willing to make in public, and maybe he's amended that since then. But I can you share that?
Well, I've enjoyed interactions with Michael. He's a good guy and a fun debating partner, and mm-hmm. he's congenial, which is not always the case, as you know, when you have these debates
yes.
about fundamental metaphysical issues. Sometimes
right.
they get pretty personal and nasty. But we were in the car on the way, and he always begins the debates he's done with me by telling his deconversion story about how he was a Christian and then ceased to be because of science. And so I just asked Michael, you know, what is it about science that led to that change of worldview? And he said, well, it was just, you know, the success of science. And I said, well, with respect to what? And he said, well, you know, like the discovery of DNA and the Big Bang. And I said, wait a minute, Michael, you just acknowledged to me in our debate that you did not have an explanation, a materialistic evolutionary explanation for the origin of the information in the DNA molecule that's necessary to build the first living cell. And he said, well, yeah, but that's kind of an anomaly. And I said, but is it really? What about, you mentioned the Big Bang. We can't have a materialistic explanation for the origin of the material world.
Right.
And yet the Big Bang is attesting to the very idea that the material world, the world of matter, space, time, and energy had a definite beginning. And he said, yeah. But again, it's kind of, and I said, and then while we're at it, what about the fine tuning? And he said, well, you mean the fine tuning of the laws and constants of physics? I said, yeah.
That would be one example, right?
And I said, he said, well, there's the multiverse. And I said, well, but Michael, do you really believe that? And he said, nah. And so I was afraid, you know, it was a little, one of only maybe two things I did in the book as far as telling stories that someone might contest later as kiss and tell, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah. So I was afraid he might have a different memory of the account when we finally got to do an interview, which we did. We had a wonderful 2-hour podcast on his
plausible deniability.
Yeah, but he didn't deny that. In fact, the week before he'd published an article by a very good cosmologist at University of California, San Diego, Brian Keating, who was wrote an article expressing his skepticism about the multiverse, and that was published in Skeptic magazine.
So I
had the interview without any fear of contradiction of the story.
So, well, we'll get to some of these concepts that, like the multiverse and the fine tuning, it's really at the heart of your whole argument in your book, Return of the God Hypothesis. Once again, Stephen C. Meyer here with me, and devoting this whole hour just to this book. I wish we had 2 hours, but
hey, Greg, could I pick up one little loose end from just what we were covering before?
Of course.
Just because you asked such a good question about the title of the book, Return of the God Hypothesis. The title implies a story, which is that science arose in a theistic milieu, in a Judeo-Christian cultural context for Judeo-Christian reasons. And the early scientists believed they were finding confirmation of that worldview in nature as they studied it. But that perspective was lost in the late 19th century with figures like Marx and Darwin and Freud, and many of the evolutionary scientists who were first coming on the scene, like Huxley and Haeckel and others. And so a new worldview came to predominate by the end of the 19th century, the early 20th century, which scholars now call scientific materialism. So science, whereas science seemed to support theism or was predicated on theism or both in the period of the scientific revolution, by the end of the 19th century, we get a more materialistic worldview that comes out of science. And we've kind of inherited that into the 20th and 21st. Mm-hmm. But the story of the book is essentially a rise, fall, rise story, that science arose in a theistic context. We lost that view, but it's coming back or should be coming back because of major discoveries that scientists have made in the 20th century about biological and cosmological origins. So there's a story arc to the book.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's great. And it's coming back with a force, too. And we've talked about this over the years, just the evidence that is compiling in support of an intelligent designer, and now coming public here. No duh. Yeah, this the only one that's going to satisfy that requirement, given all the evidence, is a supernatural designer. I don't want to leave Michael Shermer so quickly, though, because I've debated him, and you're right. He's a pleasant debate partner, as it were. But I remember one of the things that he mentions in his, or at least the one I heard about his own deconversion is an unanswered prayer, a very dramatic unanswered prayer circumstance with his girlfriend. And so there's also a subjective element there, you know, but his general thing is, I don't believe in God, I believe in science. And to me, that's like saying, I don't believe in God, I believe in my Cuisinart. You know, well, you can have a Cuisinart and still believe in God. It's the false dichotomy, you know. Yeah. But if he thinks God's going to explain everything, then – and maybe you can respond to this, because this he says a lot with regards to these unanswered things. And he shrugs and he says, why can't we just say we don't know? Why can't we just say we don't know? We don't know how the DNA formed or where the information – we don't know about the fine tune. Well, why can't we just say that? My simple response is because we do know. We do know. We have every reason to know that there is an explanation that is perfectly adequate to the test here. You just don't like it.
Well, and this goes back to what we were talking about with the method of inference to the best explanation. The idea of a best explanation isn't subjective, but there are key criteria of a best explanation that have developed in the practice of science over the centuries. And one of the key criterion is the idea of causal adequacy. Darwin used this method of reasoning, and he had a mentor named Charles Lyell, who said that when we're trying to reconstruct an event or explain an event that occurred in the remote past, we need to look for causes that are now in operation. In other words, our uniform and repeated experience, another Lyellian phrase, of cause and effect, should guide our assessment of the plausibility of the explanations that we offer for events in the remote past. Yeah. And I came across this as I was thinking about this puzzle, this mystery of the digital code that's stored in the DNA molecule. And if I could just take a little tiny riff on that, and we'll come back to the causal adequacy idea. But in 1957, 4 years after Watson and Crick elucidated the structure of DNA, Crick formulated something called the sequence hypothesis, in which he proposed that the four chemical subunits that run along the interior of the spine of the DNA molecule are functioning like alphabetic characters in a written text.
This double helix thing that
you got the double helix DNA
and the rungs on the ladder,
right?
So
and then the inside you've got these chemical subunits that we depict as little blocks with actual letters in them, and that's because Crick realized that they were functioning exactly like letters in a written text, or like the zeros and ones in a section of software, which is to say, they are not performing a function biologically in virtue of any of their physical or chemical properties. It's not because of their mass or their weight or their specific chemistry, but rather it's their arrangement in accord with an independent symbol convention, which we now know and call the genetic code. So you've got an abstract coding system built into the cell that allows information in one form to be translated into information in another form for building what Crick anticipated, for building the protein molecules that keep us alive. So a great analogy for what's going on inside the cell is something like CAD/CAM, computer-assisted design and engineering, where a computer or where an engineer will sit at a console, write some code, it'll go down a wire, it'll be translated into another machine code that can be read at a manufacturing center, and then that information will be used, for example, if you're at Boeing, to maybe put the rivets on the airplane wing at just the right place. You've got digital information directing the construction of a mechanical system. Mm-hmm. We have exactly the same thing going on inside the cell. We've got digital code directing the construction of the protein molecules and machines that keep cells alive. Crick first realized this in 1957 and since then we've had this big unanswered question in evolutionary biology, which is, where did that information come from?
Right.
Back to the point about causal adequacy, what I realized in my PhD work was if causal adequacy is the key criterion of a best explanation, there is only one adequate cause, only one known cause that produces information, especially in a digital or alphabetic form, and that's intelligence or mind. Mm-hmm. And so the discovery of digital code at the foundation of life, I've argued, is a powerful indicator of a designing intelligence in the history of life.
So this like a lot of conversations, has taken on a life of its own. So now we're on point three, and I haven't done
out of order.
But that's okay. No, it doesn't matter, because you did a great job of characterizing this whole thing about the information that's resident there in the DNA. And it's not the information is something other than the chemical properties themselves. And I remember, you probably don't remember this, but in 1993, when you gave a lecture for the MA Phil program for J.P. Moreland over at Talbot, I was a first-year student there. We had met before, but you were doing this little class, and you held. I actually used this illustration just the other day, because it's so good, and I'm holding a piece of paper in my hand right here that's got notes on about our interview, right? And you held up a piece of paper like this, and you said you could know everything physically about this that is possible to know about the ink and the paper and the weights. You could have omniscient knowledge of all the physical stuff, but you would never know what it says. In other words, how this physical thing tokens some other piece of information that is represented here. It was so powerful. I mean, it gave me chills when I heard it, and I thought, I don't have to write this down. I'm never going to forget it, because it was such a great example of how the physical stuff doesn't tell you anything about the information.
The chemistry of the ink binding to paper, which we can use chemical principles to describe how that works, does not tell us anything about the information encoded in the symbols that are represented with that ink or that.
Yeah.
And to your earlier point, too, in response to Michael Shermer, the reason we don't say we don't know is that we have uniform and repeated experience of a particular cause and only one type of cause that produces information. So when we find information in the absence of having been able to observe its coming into existence, because there's only one cause of information. We can retrodict from the cause or from the effect back to the cause. If it's true that where there's smoke, there's fire, if I see smoke wafting up above, coming up from a hillside beyond, I can infer that there's fire below. I don't have to say, well, let's just stay agnostic about this. Well, if it's also true that only minds produce information, when we find information, then we can infer with relative confidence that a mind played a role.
Well, this goes to another kind of side issue that I wanted to get to sooner or later, and it just jumped right out, and that is this. What you just said speaks to the charge that all we're doing is a God of the gaps kind of game to cover what we don't know by sticking God in there. And go
these
ahead, because I know you have a great response to this.
Well, you've provoked me now. but these are not arguments from ignorance. God of the gaps is another way of saying that you're committing the informal fallacy of an argument from ignorance, where you're saying, and such an argument would have the following form. We have some cause or some effect E, and we have a good strong reason for thinking that cause A can't produce that effect. If I therefore immediately infer that cause B did it, without offering any positive evidence that cause B can produce such an effect, then I've argued from ignorance. Okay, but that's not how we're arguing in the case of for example, the inference to intelligent design. We have an effect, namely digital information or specified complexity. There's a lot of different ways to characterize it very precisely, but we have an effect that we know from our uniform and repeated experience arises from mind. We also have good reasons for thinking that various materialistic evolutionary explanations cannot produce that effect, and that's why my books are so long, as I go through patiently these competing explanations, particularly the evolutionary or materialistic ones.
Right.
And so we're not just saying, well, because the evolutionary process of mutation and selection doesn't produce information, therefore it must have been God or it must have been a mind. But we're not arguing in that fashion. We're also saying, but we have independent knowledge that conscious activity does produce this particular kind of effect. And since it's the only known cause of that type of effect, we can infer with confidence back to that type of cause as an explanation. That's an inference to the best explanation. It's not an argument from ignorance, for the simple reason that we're offering positive warrant or evidence for an alternative causal explanation.
You know, I have for a long time now, many, many years, I have thought with, I think, justification that this move, you're arguing God of the gaps, is circular. And I'll tell why in just a moment. But I was so thrilled when I read some writing you did in Theistic Evolution that made the same point, because I passed this by a couple people, the smart people, and they didn't get it. But the only reason they think there's a gap is because there's no materialistic explanation.
Right.
And there must be a materialistic explanation because materialism is true. But that's the very thing that you're trying to demonstrate in the circumstance, whether or not it's true. And so if you assume it's true to fill the gap, as it were, then you are arguing in a circle.
I unpack that same argument in the new book as well, near the end, in chapter 20, near the very end.
Good. Showing well, it's that, a chapter 22. Yeah. I didn't get there yet.
Yeah, no, you're probably not there yet. But I actually reprised the same argument that I developed with Paul Nelson in the Theistic Evolution book, showing the circularity of that it presupposes the very pointed issue. Yeah, you're absolutely right.
That's a great – okay, so now we covered point number three, which is information in the DNA double helix, best explanation for the way things are. That would be an intelligent mind. We know that's what produces code, and that's what we have here in the DNA. Let's drop back to my first point, which is huge. You spent a lot of time in it, and that's the origin of the universe, okay? And can you kind of walk us through a little bit? We got about 20 minutes to go here in our show. Things are moving quickly. We got – lots of things to talk about.
Lots to talk about, sure.
This is so important, and I think it can be sometimes overly complex. So can you just give us a little bit of the history of this drama of the whole question of the origin of the universe and how it plays so importantly into the argument in your book, The Return of God?
Let me give the big picture explanation of the relevance of this evidence to the question that I wanted to address, which is who is the designing intelligence? What can we tell about the attributes of the designing intelligence of life and the universe? If we bring in evidence from cosmology, clearly no being within the cosmos could be responsible for the origin of the universe itself, or the origin, we'll talk about next, of its finely tuned characteristics that were set from the very beginning. If those characteristics in the universe were necessary to a space alien arising, then no space alien could be responsible for the origin of the universe itself. So that's getting into the cosmology and the physics helps adjudicate between those two competing design hypotheses concerning the origin of life. But let's set that aside now and go back to your main question. It's a fascinating story. For most of the 19th century, and probably for much of Western history, many philosophers and scientists had adopted the Aristotelian view that the universe was eternal, or it had existed for an infinitely long period of time. Some philosophers and theologians, Thomas Aquinas, took on faith that the universe had a finite beginning, but it was a very hard thing to prove one way or another. And by the late 19th century, most physicists accepted a kind of materialistic hypothesis that the universe was the eternal self-existent thing. It played the role in a materialistic worldview that God played in a theistic worldview. That is to say, it was the thing or the entity or the process from which everything else comes, what James Sire calls the prime reality in his books on worldview.
Right.
And the shocking and surprising thing of the early 20th century physics, astrophysics, and cosmology was the discovery that the universe had a beginning. It started in the 19-teens. There was an American astronomer named Vesto Slipher who first realized that the light coming from distant nebula was what's called redshifted. It was being stretched out. The wavelengths were longer than it should be if those nebula were in a stationary position relative to the Earth. So if the light was being stretched out, that implied that the nebula were moving away from us.
Mm-hmm.
But at that time, people still weren't sure whether the nebula were just gas clouds around stars within our Milky Way or whether they represented galaxies beyond our Milky Way. And so in the 1920s, Edwin Hubble was able to use some new techniques for measuring distance to objects in the night sky that had been developed by the Harvard astronomer Henrietta Leavitt. And he was able to determine, for example, that the Andromeda galaxy was 900,000 light years away from us, and yet our whole galaxy was only thought to be 300,000 light years across. So clearly it must be beyond. And as similar measurements were made, it became apparent that we lived in a great big universe, much bigger than we'd ever imagined,
right,
and that these nebula were actually galaxies in their own right, and that the light coming from them was indeed redshifted. It was stretched out. The wavelengths were being stretched out to indicate that the object from which they were coming was receding away from us. Like the phenomena your listeners would be familiar with, I'm sure, the Doppler shift in sound. If a train whistle recedes from us, the pitch of the sound will drop. As the train is receding, the wavelength of the sound gets longer.
Kind of a thing,
So this led to the conclusion, eventually, that these different galaxies in every quadrant of the night sky were receding away from us, indicating in a universe that is expanding outward in the forward direction of time. But now if you wind that sequence backwards in your mind's eye, you come to a point where at every successive point, the galactic material would be closer and closer and closer and closer together in the reverse direction of time, eventually getting to a point where you can't back extrapolate any further. Everything converges to a point, marking the beginning of the expansion of the universe, but then arguably also the beginning of the universe itself.
Right, right, right. It's so powerful. I mean, I have a very simple way of putting this, and I know the Big Bang is controversial for some Christians because of their own understanding of Genesis 1 and age and et cetera. But it seems I like the notion of Big Bang, since so many non-Christians hold it to be so, with, I think, good justification. And it matches our story so much because our story starts in the beginning, bang, you know, God created the heavens and the earth. And my simple way of putting that is a Big Bang needs a Big Banger, okay? There you go. There's my cosmological argument in a nutshell,
Let me unpack that using a little of this inference to the best explanation reasoning that we've been talking about. If you look at we have multiple indications that the universe had a beginning. It's hard to prove anything with absolute certainty in science, but we have multiple very strong indicators and one very interesting proof, which is something called the Bord-Guth-Vilenkin theorem, which uses special relativity to show that there must have been a beginning to time and space. But if you take that collective body of data, you have a strong reason to think that the universe itself, the physical universe of matter, space, time, and energy came into existence a finite time ago.
Right.
Now, if matter comes into existence a finite time ago, then whatever caused the universe to come into existence cannot be explained by reference to matter, because before the origin of matter, there was no matter to do the causing. Same with energy.
Right.
And so whatever it is that is necessary to explain the origin of the universe is a matter of the causal profile. The entity that is required to explain the origin of the universe must transcend matter, space, time, and energy. It must also have power, and it must have the power to initiate a change of state from nothing physical to everything we see. So that implies volitional capabilities, which suggests a mind. And so I think as you begin to look at it, it implies agency. And so as you look at the various worldviews on offer, theism posits an agent with great power that exists independent of the physical universe. Deism does as well, but materialism does not. Pantheism does not, because the god of pantheism is coextensive with matter and has no existence independent of the universe. So if the universe comes into existence, at that point the pantheistic god must have come into existence. So the pantheistic god can't act as a causal agent. Anyway, you can go through a process of reasoning like this, and from the evidence that we have of cosmology, astrophysics, and physics alone, I think you can make a very strong case for a transcendent creator of some kind, either a theistic or deistic one.
Mm-hmm.
And then you bring in the other evidences that I look at in the book, and I think you get a stronger they collectively support theism over deism.
Well, I think Big Bang cosmology is such a thoroughgoing defeater for materialism that there's an explanation. Talk about explanatory power for why the concept was resisted so aggressively in the early to mid 20th century. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Some fantastic, quotations. Arthur Eddington, who actually brought Einstein into the picture about the expanding universe, and said, "Look, you got to drop your objection to this." Einstein resisted the Big Bang initially because he thought it was based on Christian theology. And Lemaître, who was a Catholic priest, said, "No, the case for the Big Bang is based on your equations of general relativity once solved," which Lemaître did.
Busted.
And the evidence of the red shift. And they had a famous discussion in a taxi cab, on a taxi cab ride to a physics conference in 1927, where Lemaître confronted him, Einstein, with the evidence of the red shift. Later, Eddington did the same thing when Einstein came to Cambridge. But Eddington himself, who wanted to get Einstein to, open his mind, didn't like the Big Bang concept. He said that, the notion that this present order of things started off with a bang is preposterous. It leaves me cold. So the opposite, but he said it was philosophically the notion was preposterous. And the philosophy that led him to dislike it was materialism. And so this was the problem, is that the materialistic philosophy can't explain the origin of matter. It has to presuppose eternal self-existent matter, which was the very thing that the evidence of the Big Bang was challenging.
Well, we see this same fight going on constantly. I gave a talk last week in Minneapolis about science and faith. Are they compatible? And I said, well, depends a lot of things, but it depends what you mean by science. And if you mean science as a methodology, there's no problem, as you've discussed. But if you mean science as a materialistic philosophy, well, then you're going to have banging heads, because they're two different worldviews. And this consistently gets imported into these discussions.
Of course.
And
of
when
course.
Somebody says it's not scientific what you believe, one thinks that you're not doing good methodology, when in fact what they're saying is that your conclusions don't comport with our required materialistic philosophy.
Sure. And Greg, my argument is in a sense even a bit more aggressive in that, maybe more radical in that sense, is that I'm arguing that the evidence that we have from science, not just the methodologies that we use, but the evidence that we have about biological, physical, and cosmological origins is not only compatible with theistic belief, it's best explained by such belief.
Yeah.
And therefore, we have warrant for theism coming out of science, that there's epistemic support for a theistic worldview from the scientific discoveries that have been made in the last 100 years.
Absolutely. And my guest, Stephen C. Meyer, his latest book, Return of the God Hypothesis, subtitled Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. We just put that on our website, so on str.org. We have it in our bookstore. You can purchase it there if you want to get a copy. I have a little citation here that in my notes for this interview that I don't completely understand, but I'm just going to read it and then you could tell the story because I think you will, but I think it relates to what we're talking about here, pushback, etc. And what my note says here, Stephen, you write something provocative in the prologue that the allegedly strongest counter arguments against ID often inadvertently seem to strengthen rather than weaken the case for design. Then you cite Alexander Belenkin's versus Lawrence Krauss interpretation of Lincoln. This is, and I wrote, this strikes me as a really important observation. I don't remember what that is, but does this strike,
Sure.
Does sound familiar to you?
Yeah,
okay,
sure.
Good.
Let me, I mean, I had one of my Cambridge supervisors said, beware the sound of one hand clapping, meaning if there's an argument on one side, there's bound to be an argument on the other. And the way to test the strength of an argument is to see how well it survives or sustains itself in the face of opposition. Mm-hmm. And I think I set up the last quarter of the book with that little story and to, in a sense, lay down a challenge to myself. Okay, we've made the first order case for theism from these big discoveries. Now, how well does that case withstand critical scrutiny? Let me give you one example of how the case for the God hypothesis, in this case a theistic design hypothesis, is actually reinforced by one of the allegedly strongest claims in opposition to it. The third class of evidence, or the second one, depending on how you count,
and in your book,
Big Bang is the fine-tuning evidence.
Okay, this is a good transition here to this point.
What we sometimes call the evidence of a Goldilocks universe, that you have all these fundamental parameters of physics, the force that's creating the expansion of the universe, the force of gravity, the strength of the electromagnetic force, the ratios between those forces, the masses of the elementary particles, and on we could go. These very fundamental physical parameters that for some unknown, that is to say, for no underlying reason of physical theory, have very precise strengths or values that turn out to be crucial to the existence of a life-conducive universe. You change that force of expansion by a little bit. It's called the cosmological constant. The current estimate is by 1 × 10⁻⁹ in either direction, and you either get a big collapse of the universe or you get a heat death. In neither case do you have a life-conducive universe.
Can I interrupt just a second? I just want to make sense of that number. As I understand it, that number is larger than the number of elementary particles in the universe. That is like atoms and neutrons.
Right.
I mean, the whole
quarks.
Elementary would be, all the way down. Really big.
Yeah, to put the degree of fine-tuning in context, it's 10 billion times more finely tuned than, let me put it in context. It would be like putting a blind man out in space, getting the fine-tuning of the cosmological constant correct by chance would be equivalent probabilistically to letting a blindfolded man float out into the universe looking for one elementary particle, but not just in our universe, but in 10 billion universes our size. So getting it right has that degree of exquisite fine-tuning or improbability associated with it.
It ain't going to happen.
And there's multiple parameters that are exquisitely exponentially finely tuned. So the obvious explanation from many physicists who started to discover these things, including Fred Hoyle, was a staunch scientific atheist who opposed the Big Bang on philosophical grounds, came around to theism because of his discovery of many of these fine-tuning parameters. And he said a common-sense interpretation suggests a super-intellect. But there's a counter-argument, and that's where I think that's where I want to go.
We got 3 minutes.
3 minutes. Sorry. All right, good. We'll get this in. The counter-argument is what's known as the multiverse, the idea that, yes, all these fine-tuning parameters are incredibly improbable, but if we posit enough other universes out there, then in some universe, the correct combination of exquisitely finely-tuned parameters would have arisen, making life possible, and we just happen to be in that lucky universe. So therefore, there's no problem. Well, there is a problem. And one of the problems is that just positing other universes out there doesn't explain the fine-tuning, because if the other universes are causally disconnected from our own, then they have no impact on anything that happens in our universe, including whatever process it was that set the fine-tuning parameters to the values and strengths that they have. So in virtue of that, advocates of the multiverse have proposed various universe-generating mechanisms so that they can propose our universe as kind of the a winner, a lucky winner of a great cosmic lottery where the universe-generating mechanisms are spitting out all these different universes. So there's a common cause connection between all the universes. And this is where the rub comes in, because it turns out that even in theory, the proposed universe-generating mechanisms, some based on something called string theory, others based on something called inflationary cosmology, these universe-generating mechanisms require prior unexplained fine-tuning in order to plausibly produce new universes. You don't get rid of the fine-tuning. You just push it out of view, and the ultimate fine-tuning is still unexplained. And yet, we know of only one cause in the universe that produces what we call fine-tuning, which is an ensemble of improbable parameters that work together to perform a function, and that cause is intelligence, whether we're talking about a finely tuned French recipe or an internal combustion engine or the universe.
Oh, Stephen, you did it. I got 60 seconds to close here. It is so frustrating having an hour restriction on our conversation because there's so much more to talk about. Stephen Meyer's new book, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe, and that would be the origin of the universe, that would be the fine-tuning of the universe that we just talked about, and that would also be the origin of information, especially on the DNA double helix. Now, I put them in the proper order there. It wasn't the order we talked about them in.
We
covered all the bases. And I just let me just say this to you guys, and I don't mean to embarrass you, Stephen, but I have found Stephen Meyer's works on intelligent design to be the very best single source of information that I need to get up to speed on the best arguments and the best research for ID. And also, I think the best responses to the best arguments against intelligent design. And this is what that you focus on in the end of your book. So, Stephen, thank you so much for spending this rapid hour together. It was wonderful.
It went by fast because it was fun, and you asked great questions, Greg. So thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you. All the best. Once again, Stephen C. Meyer, Return of the God Hypothesis, Three Scientific Discoveries That Reveal the Mind Behind the Universe. Okay, friends, that's it. Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. You give them heaven. Bye-bye now.